Greetings to the brightest audience in America. This is Fred Williams bringing you another edition of Real Science Friday. My co-host Bob Inyard is on special assignment, or should I say special confinement. If that's perked your curiosity, you can go to kgov.com to find the whereabouts of Mr. Inyard. Today we've got a very special guest in the studio, Dr. Rob Carter from Creation Ministries International. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Carter spent several years, I think 4 years, teaching high school biology, chemistry, physics, and electronics before you ventured off to the University of Miami to get a PhD in marine biology. That sounds real interesting.
It was a lot of fun.
So, Miami Hurricanes, are you a big hurricane fan then?
Well, I would have to be, but I still, my loyalties, of course, with my alma mater, Georgia Tech, but shh, don't tell
UM
that.
Well, we were in Orlando about 6 years ago when Hurricane Charlie went through, and I've got a whole new appreciation of your school mascot name, the Hurricanes. Hurricane, whenever I see one on the weather report now, I take a little bit more extra notice because unless you experience one, it was something else. Have you been through a hurricane?
I lived there for 9 years and experienced several, including several that destroyed several experiments that I had out in the ocean. It was very frustrating to have 6 months of work washed away.
Oh, that's interesting. What kind of experiments?
Oh, a plate that we were looking for coral larvae to settle on. We're looking at coral growth rates, doing some experiments with some sea urchins. And then this hurricane would come through and everything was gone.
Oh, wow. So was this part of your creation research?
No, that was my doctoral work.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, you're in town this weekend. We're real privileged to have you. You're going to be speaking at several locations. I know Friday night, you'll be at Holly Hills Bible Church. And this is on I-25 in Evans. You go east on Evans a little ways to Holly, and then you head south, and the church is about 4 or 5 blocks down on the east side of the street. That again, is at 7 o'clock tonight. And what's your topic?
My topic is the genetics of Genesis.
Wow, now that sounds really interesting. Would you like to give the audience a preview of what that'll be like?
Well, essentially, I'm going to make the case that modern genetics has rediscovered the book of Genesis and has essentially validated the main predictions that the book of Genesis would make about human history, even though modern genetics did not want to prove the book of Genesis to be true.
Yeah, secular sources usually don't want something like that to happen.
No, not at all.
So, genetics is personally a favorite topic of mine. I'm a software engineer by trade. And there's a lot of similarities. You know, with genetics, they have an inherent with genetics is a computer program, the language of life, the DNA. It's like a blueprint that tells the, how to build the body. Instruction, semantics, syntax.
And just like a computer program, it doesn't happen by accident.
Oh, it's impossible. I know from information theory, it's not possible to have a code, a language, happen by chance. It's not that it's remotely unlikely, it's flat impossible. And when they discovered the DNA and that there was a computer language, I know that Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers, he ended up abandoning neo-Darwinism. And because he was committed to being an atheist, he admitted that life couldn't have come here by, these Darwinistic mechanisms. But he postulated that aliens seeded our planet with this, I guess, pre-life forms, this information. They call it
panspermia.
Panspermia, yes. So, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because I know I get, I see this question a lot by evolutionists. It's one of the many illusions they use is their arguments. And one of them is, well, man and chimps share 97% similarity in the DNA. Now, on the surface, that sounds kind of interesting, kind of compelling. But when you get behind it, there's an illusion behind it. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
A lot of people's faith has been wrecked on the idea that humans and chimpanzees are so similar genetically. 99%, 98%, 97%. It's just a high number that have been quoted for a long time. On the one hand, we should probably expect that humans and chimps are fairly similar because we look the same, we eat the same foods, we survive in the same temperature, we have the same body plan. So any of that genetics that controls those things is going to be shared between us. But there was a paper published a little over a year ago called Relative Differences, The Myth of 1%. And it was published in the most prestigious science journal in the world. And in that paper, the author says, well, we've known for years that humans and chimpanzees are much more than 1% different, or much less than 99% different. It's hard to say it that way. But it was convenient.
Exactly. I mean, they weren't counting things like areas of the DNA that they didn't think had a function, for one thing.
Yes. And that junk DNA, the so-called junk DNA, is turning out to be not only a treasure trove of information for us, but also to be highly regulated information structures that they didn't know what the function were before. And there's a lot of differences between humans and chimps, especially in the junk DNA.
Yeah, what people don't realize, even if at 97%, if there's, 3 to 4 billion nucleotides in the DNA, say 3 billion, you do the math on 3%, that's 90 million differences. And genetically, it's real difficult for a change to be fixed in a population. There's going to be a speed limit, right? There's going to be a reproductive capacity, especially in the higher vertebrates. It's just going to take longer for a mutation to fixate. And I don't know, Haldane had that famous calculation in 57.
Haldane's dilemma, which has still not been answered and is getting worse.
Oh, it's absolutely getting worse, because as they find more function in the DNA,
yes,
it makes the problem even worse. Especially the one I love is how they compared chimps to humans and they came up with a mutation rate of 3 per person per generation. But when you run the math on that, and you do, like a Poisson distribution, that means you have to have 40, each breeding couple has to produce 40 offspring just to account for that part of Haldane's dilemma, just to keep the population from going extinct. So when people get behind the numbers of this 97%, it shows that there's an illusion behind their argument. But on the surface, it sounds interesting, but it's deceptive.
Okay, let's not lose the audience here, right? We're talking about a lot of math and a lot of theory and things like that. There are articles on creation.com. That's our ministry's website.
Yeah, that's the Creation Ministries International's website. It's a great URL, creation.com. Not sure how you guys got that, but that's awesome.
But there are articles addressing those things that you're discussing.
Yes.
Human-chimp similarities, Haldane's dilemma, and things like that. And so if someone's out there wondering and want more information, go there.
Yeah, that's a great, great place to go. Another question that comes to mind that I hear a lot of, and it's fairly more recent, is this argument that DNA, or that there's these pseudogenes that have shared mistakes between chimps and humans. And the reason, again, I'm bringing that up is because I'm hearing this more and more, and I'm hoping that you can help the audience refute that argument.
I was in a debate. It was called the Great Dothan Creation Evolution Debate 2 years ago, and my opponent brought up that very argument and brought it up again and again and again and again and again. It was actually kind of frustrating because I thought I answered and he kept on saying it. But essentially, yeah, there are several so-called pseudogenes shared between humans, chimps, and gorillas.
That pseudogenes are?
It looks like a protein-coding gene, but it's not functional. It's broken. And we have these, it looks broken.
Exactly.
Okay, sorry, it looks broken. We have these things that look like the other gene that works, but it doesn't do anything, supposedly. And so, therefore, the evolutionists assume it doesn't do anything, and therefore, it has no function. It's something that happened in the remote evolutionary past. This gene was copied and then deactivated, and we've inherited it all this time, and therefore we share it.
And it sounds like I heard a few assumptions in there.
But my biggest...
that it's functional, or that it's not functional.
That it's functionless. Yeah, remember the vestigial organ argument from the 1800s? They had a list of over 200 organs in the human body that were vestigial or functionless or hardly working anymore. Well, that list is now down to zero. Even the appendix and the human tonsils, we know they have very valid, working, useful functions and are important.
It reminds me of how evolution leads to bad science, because then people had their tonsils removed many years ago for very, very likely the wrong reasons, because they just didn't feel like they had a function. Now they're a lot more careful about taking them out. There has to be a compelling reason.
Yes. About 10 years ago, I had my tonsils operated on, but they didn't take them out.
Okay.
The doctor said, oh, we're not taking those out. I was like, oh, you mean they have a function? He's like, oh, yes, they have a very, very important function. Oh, thank you, doctor. The vestigial organ argument for pseudogenes is dangerous, because it's an argument from silence. It's the argument, well, we don't think they have a function, or we don't know the function, therefore they must not have any function. But it's not a good way to argue, because all you have to do is go out there and find a function for it, and you've disproven it. And pseudogenes today I mean, every month I read a new paper that's talking about some unbelievable function for the junk DNA that they didn't expect.
Absolutely. And you know, for example, I've read things where in the pseudogenes they find a mutation that they seem to track to a disease of some sort. So if they're finding some examples like that, that obviously it must have a function, right?
Yes.
If you mutate it and then it makes you less healthy, it's obviously has to have a purpose. So we talked about, I think it was either the last show or the show before, that now they've found that these silent parts of the codon, you know, this piece of information that everybody thought was silent, that turns out to have a function. It's amazing. Yeah, the complexity of the DNA.
There are very few parts in the genome that you can change and not have at least a subtle effect. Most mutations are hardly visible for natural selection. They're so small. The effect is so tiny, and it depends on all these other mutations around it, but they're still negative. They do add up.
Yes. Somebody used an analogy, the Princess and the Pea. You know,
yeah, John Sanford's book.
What a great book.
Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome.
Yes.
Which I've read many, many times.
Yeah, and how can natural selection see these small changes, especially with all the noise that occurs with other things in the DNA?
Yeah, there's a review of that book on creation.com.
Great.
Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome.
Okay. So I had a third question, and
humans, chimps, and apes, and gorillas sharing these so-called pseudogenes and being evidence of evolution. Well, my obvious answer is, if that little piece of DNA is functionless, then how come over the last 10 million years it has not accumulated any new mutations?
Yes, and that's
a killer.
That is.
That is an indication that, and you know, that rule of thumb in biology, that form follows function. It's an indication that that piece of DNA has a function because we have a shared form, a shared stretch of DNA amongst these three different species that have supposedly been separated for all these millions of years. It must have a function, or it would have been decayed away by now through mutation.
Yeah, it wouldn't have mattered that a mutation hit there.
Right.
So, but if it has a function, then obviously, okay. Here's another favorite one of evolutionists, and it's a straw man argument, but I want you to address it because it is very common. I think I hear this almost more than anything. And that's, and from your line of expertise, I think you could address this much better than I could. How do you explain the millions of species? How did Noah get millions of species on the ark?
Our dogs, coyotes, wolves, African jackals, and Australian dingoes, different species?
I would say no.
No, because they're all interfertile.
Yeah.
So just one dog kind.
That's right.
Lions and tigers, one species. They can interbreed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the breeding barriers between species, the number of species reduces dramatically. And then, of course, there are some things like horses and donkeys that can breed but don't produce often a fertile offspring, which has been questioned in the recent past also. But that could easily be a mutation that has caused a lack of the ability of a former species to be able to breed with itself. There's a book called Noah's Ark of Feasibility Study.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Great book written by John Woodmerappy. And he went through and counted up the number of kinds of animals in the world. And there's 12,000
pairs. Yeah, I thought
he was
12,000, 13,000. And he was
animals.
Being conservative.
Yeah.
And you could fit these 13,000 or so on the ark easily. I think you could fit it in 20% of the ark. There's plenty of room for food storage.
Yeah. But the ark needs to have 12,000 or so pairs of animals, plus all the water and all the food for a one-year journey. And that is doable.
Very doable.
It wouldn't be any fun, but it's doable.
Yeah. Okay. Last month at our RMCF meeting, that's Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, where you will again be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Holly Hills Church. And by the way, our website is youngearth.org. If you want to go there to find details, to click and find the map, how to get there, and what Dr. Carter's going to be talking about. Last month we showed a docudrama called The Voyage That Shook the World. And I believe that did CMI produce that movie?
CMI did produce that, yes.
Okay, and you were featured in that documentary. That was excellent.
I had some speaking roles, yeah.
Yeah. Well, would you like to share a little bit about the film and your role? It was, first of all, it was basically about Darwin's travels from England and around, South America up to the Galapagos Islands. It kind of traced his his, you know, his traveling, and you were part of that documentary. So,
well, this year is Darwin's 200th birthday and 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species, and so we realized it was going to be a big year of Darwin, and we also realized that there was going to be some documentaries made this year, and so we wanted to produce one for ourselves, but we didn't want to make a Christian documentary that people will say, oh, that's just Christian junk, and turn it off. So we tried to really downplay our beliefs, and what we did is we went around the world. We went to places Darwin went, a lot of places. We said, Darwin went here, he saw this, and he wrote this, and nobody believes that today. And we went from place to place to place to place, and then we went around the world interviewing all those evolutionists, and we said things like, if Darwin were alive today, based on what we know about science, what would he have to say, or how would his theory have changed, and do we still believe what he wrote? And we allowed the evolutionists to say all the points that we wanted to say. And we put together, I mean, we spent $1 million on this. There's some historical reenactment, a lot of historical reenactments, really neat graphics. It's a powerful movie.
Very well produced. It was excellent. Now, is it available to the public now? I know we kind of got a special showing last month.
It will be released on September 1st.
Okay.
We are right now screening it all over the country, in fact, all over the world. Out of our 7 international offices, so it's being shown a lot. And it'll be shown here on Sunday, and Parker at...
Oh, Parker, okay. You're going to be talking at Grace Baptist Parker at 2:30 p.m.
2:30 p.m.
on Sunday. By the way, Dr. Carter will also be speaking at 9 o'clock at Peace Lutheran in Arvada. And we want to thank Dennis Hoffs for helping set that up. He's a great friend of Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. So, this DVD sounds great. And again, I think people are probably going to be able to buy it if they go to creation.com. You'll have it in your bookstore.
Yes.
And again, we saw it. It was very well produced. It was remarkable. Was Darwin right about anything that you guys covered? I mean, other than maybe, birds are related.
Well, we complimented him on the things that he needed to be complimented on. Because we try not to make him look like the boogeyman. We try to be real honest. We essentially, if you watched a documentary of Jesus on the History Channel, you'd walk away very frustrated because of this thing called historical revisionism. They would have taken the character of Jesus and shredded it. Well, knowing that's the sign of the times and a way to do things, we said, let's do something similar, but let's actually be honest about it. And we just tried to tell the truth.
And it really comes out that way. You weren't trying to bash Darwin or evolutionists, just presenting the facts.
Yeah.
So, somebody who watched one of those Jesus shows on the History Channel, if they were a secularist, they'd probably come away thinking, wow, that was great. And unfortunately, it deceives a lot of people.
Yeah.
Your film is great that it's getting the truth out there. I'm curious, how did you become a creationist? It's rare, for PhD scientists, at least, to be openly creationist. We're getting more and more, but I know it's not an easy thing, especially with the pressures, in the universities. I personally know people who that weren't able to get their PhD when it was discovered that they were a creationist.
It was treacherous ground several times. I became a creationist my freshman year in college. I came from a liberal Christian background with no grounding in theology, no grounding in scriptures. And my freshman year, I got hit hard with evolution unexpectedly. And my faith was falling apart. Everything was just falling apart, and I was sitting in a kitchen with this homeschool mom and her daughter, who was a music major, she was homeschooled, and you'd think that me, the science major, knew all the science, and they knew nothing, right? Well, they knew one thing I had never thought of before, and they dropped this little gold nugget in my lap. It burned a hole right in my heart.
Well, I can't wait to hear it.
It was something about whales and something about. I parroted, after saying evolution this and evolution this and evolution that, because I knew nothing else, I parroted my professor, who said, oh, let's face it, from the front of the audience. He said, let's face it, evolution's a fact. And I said that, the only time in my life I've ever said that. And they said, oh, really? Have you ever thought about blank? And they just, one little teeny piece of evidence to support the Bible, because I had never met anyone in my entire life who even attempted to support the Bible scientifically.
So maybe on the whales, it might have been their sonar. I mean, how does that?
No, I think what it was they knew a little bit about the Pachycetus fossil, And the discovery, the subsequent discovery, when they found the rest of the skeleton of Pachycetus, and it turned out it was nothing like an intermediate between a land animal and a water animal. But I didn't know that part.
And what's frustrating is it was based on just a few bone fragments.
Yeah.
And that's what they portray this in these college biology books as a full fossil. They come up with these artistic drawings. And a lot of times they're not telling the student that, hey, all we found was what was Pachycetus? Maybe part of the skull, if I recall?
It was part of the skull, part of the jaw, and a couple of teeth.
Okay. And they turn that into a whale ancestor.
Yeah, thing with these paddle-like hands that was diving after fish. It was amazing. It was so convincing, but it was a cartoon, I realized later. And I said, that's not the skeleton. It's just a cartoon.
And that happens a lot. I mean, like Nebraska Man from a single tooth. And from a single tooth, they got him and his family.
Yes.
You know, so, but yet when they look at invertebrate fossils, where you would obviously have, you know, a great deal of knowledge, that's a huge, we have a huge cache of that in the fossil record, complete specimens. And yet we never get examples, it seems like, from the invertebrate fossil record, where it seems like you should be able to find tons of examples. Instead, we get it from the vertebrate fossil record of these, and, you know, these fragments where that they turn, you know, they turn monkeys into men, et cetera.
Yes. But, you know, with the creative genius of God, it would not surprise me at all if there were millions of transitional, so-called transitional species out there, things that God created that look intermediate between one thing and another, because why does God limit it to a certain way of creating? But he didn't do that. And that's actually one of the most stunning things. God could have done that. It wouldn't have been proof for evolution, but they would have used it as proof, but God did not do that. There are huge gaps, huge disjunctions between one type of animal and another. And those intermediates are not there.
Yes. And it reminds me of Ida that was in the news here recently.
Oh, Ida. Oh, boy.
You know, and what they say that, you know, the people have been asking for the missing link. Now we have one. Well, didn't they say that 10 years or the whichever missing link they chose back then? Every 10 years, they've found it.
Yeah.
Sounds like it's been missing for a long time.
Ape fossils are exceedingly rare. And that's one of the big problems. And so they found this thing that supposedly is the missing link between ape-like creatures and other mammals, but it's not.
What do you think it is?
It's a lemur. It doesn't have the tooth comb, okay, and it doesn't have this little fancy thin fingernail they call the grooming claw. Okay, it's still a lemur. It's those little things are minor.
And I can't remember, but the guy who bought the fossil, he spent a ton of money on it.
Oh, yes.
For, you know, the publicity they seek on these things. What's your favorite evidence for creation? I'd be curious to hear.
Genetics.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
My talk tonight will be about genetics, just the evidence we find from gene sequencing and then the theory behind the mathematics of it. Everything screams creation. It screams young Earth, two initial created people, the flood, Tower of Babel. It all fits beautifully into the genetic portrait if you scrub out the evolutionary assumptions. Take away the evolutionary assumptions and the data, it's just a beautiful picture of the biblical story.
And is that kind of what you'll be talking about tonight?
That'll be my talk tonight, yes.
Okay. What about your talk at Peace Lutheran? Any highlights on that? Roughly the same thing? Or?
Let's see. The title of my talk at Peace Lutheran is The Alternative, Creation's Competitive Edge. And it's really an evangelism training tool to share with people how they can use a creation message in evangelism. My goal is to build up people's faith, but also to equip them to go out and use a couple of little keys, like what happened to me, that little gold nugget that lady and her daughter gave me. Totally unexpected. It's a powerful way to witness to people.
Yeah, for 30 years, I was part evolutionist. I mean, I didn't completely believe in evolution, but I definitely believed in millions of years. And a fellow engineer challenged me, said, oh, evolution is a proven fact, just like you had been taught. And I'm like, well, if it's a fact, there must be a lot of evidence for it. So I went out and I started investigating it. And I became shocked how little evidence, if not, you know, basically no evidence, no tangible evidence.
Tangible.
And in a way, part of me became angry that I allowed myself to be brainwashed for 30 years believing this. And then at the same time, I was reading the Bible. I was becoming more interested in the Bible. So I'm kind of more the type that came from the secular side towards the Bible, as opposed to trusting the Bible and then letting the science, you know, fit the Bible. So, and, you know, one of the problems with this and why this topic is so important if we can't believe the first book of the Bible, if we can't believe the history in Genesis, why should we believe other history in the Bible, such as the resurrection of Christ? Do you see an impact of compromising on Genesis?
Look what Jesus told Nicodemus in Gospel of John. He says, if I've told you earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things? Well, the scientific establishment has tried its best to invalidate the earthly predictions of the Bible. And once those fell away, why would anyone want to trust the Bible when it talks about religious things?
Exactly. And then there's a problem of death before sin, millions of years of death, disease, and suffering if evolution is true. I mean, well, how does that make God look, the God of the Bible?
It raises a lot of difficult-to-answer quandaries. In fact, I like to challenge people. I said, you know, I used to believe in millions of years, death and suffering, before God and Adam and Eve sort of thing. And I really wasn't sure how to fit Adam and Eve in there, but I kind of believed it. But I always had this millions of years idea. I like to challenge people. I say, I had two mutually exclusive ideas in my head. And I held them in my head until someone challenged me on them. And I like to challenge people, look and see why they're mutually incompatible and figure out which one's right.
Well, that's an awesome way to approach it because they really are mutually exclusive. I used to try to justify the dinosaurs as God created these pets and then he got tired of them and then created humans. I mean, you come up with all these calisthenics to get around the problem with how Genesis is so crystal clear that it's talking about 24 literal, you know, 24-hour days. And if you look at the genealogies, you go back roughly 6,000 years. You can't go back farther than that. And you can't. No. The Bible is clear that death is the result of our sin. Yet, if you believe in evolution, if you're a Christian who believes in millions of years, you believe in millions of years of death before sin. I've found that's been one of people I've talked to that really convicts them over time. It's like they can't reconcile that with what Scripture says.
The answer of death and the question of death is a central theme of Christianity.
I mean, absolutely.
Jesus' death on the cross is answering this whole problem that got set up with Adam. Charles Darwin stole Christianity's exclusive rights to the answer for death. And he said, oh no, death's just part of the natural order. It's always been here. It's what produced you. He stole that from Christianity. We didn't and ripped the legs out from underneath the church. And so it's not a subject that you can just willy-nilly decide what you want. This has a lot of really important ramifications on faith, on your approach to the Bible, and even asking the question, why was Jesus hanging on the cross?
Yes. So I would encourage people to really become more educated on this topic. It's a great way to witness to people because people love to talk about origins. So again, Dr. Carter will be at our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship group meeting tonight. We meet the second Friday of every month. And that's at Holly Hills Bible Church. We want to take this moment to thank Holly Hills for the many years that they've hosted our meeting. But starting next month, we have great news that we'll start meeting at Bethlehem Lutheran Church. That's at 21st and Wadsworth. Our new meeting place will be there. It's a great facility. We really look forward to that. Again, Dr. Carter will also be at Peace Lutheran in Arvada, and that's at 9 a.m. And then later that day on Sunday, this coming Sunday, he'll be at Grace Baptist in Parker at 2:30 p.m. So make sure you can make one of those, at least one of these talks by Rob. I can't wait to hear it myself. I understand he's an excellent speaker. Sunday day at 2 p.m., I'll be up north at Mount Calvary Lutheran Church giving a talk to that church. We thank you again for listening to us. Bob Inyart Live is on weekly on this station, AM 670 KLTT at 3 and 11:30 p.m. and Saturday at 8 p.m.